Without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to our moderator this evening, co-founder and executive chairman of LinkedIn, Reid Hoffman. Thank you.
So I have the rare and excellent privilege of introducing Linda, who is the CEO and co-founder of Endeavor. And she's been very justly globally recognized as an important leader in entrepreneurship, both of entrepreneurs, of entrepreneurial networks, of entrepreneurial ecosystems. And so we are here tonight to talk about her book, which is another delight for me, because so many books on entrepreneurship are really not very good, and hers is excellent. And so I highly recommend it to all of you. And then finally, of course, doing an interview with a good friend is always fun. So with that, will you also please welcome Linda?
Thank you. Great to be here.
So let's start a little bit with the Endeavor story. And I thought to break the Endeavor questions down into the three chunks of your book, which is get going, go big, go home.
Yes.
So let's start with a get going of Endeavors. How did you end up kind of founding this marvelous organization?
Well, I grew up in a traditional household in just outside of Boston, and my parents actually were high school sweethearts. They met in Rhode Island. My dad went on to be a lawyer. My mom raised the three of us children. And my parents are incredibly loving and incredibly risk averse. So some of this rubbed off on me, and I went to college and law school, got to law school, and realized I had no interest in being a lawyer. So I went off what my parents thought was a one-year, a trip to Latin America, made my way, and I fell in love with the culture. I started dancing tango and rooting for soccer teams. But this was the mid-90s now, and back home, everyone is talking about the rise of the celebrity founder, and this was the Yahoo and Netscape moment. And everybody in Latin America wanted a government job, and I found this confusing. And when I took a taxi in Buenos Aires and my taxi driver had an engineering degree, I couldn't help but ask, what are you doing driving a cab? And I said, why aren't you starting a business? And he thought this was a very odd question, and he said you couldn't do that. And I said, well, no, why aren't you becoming an entrepreneur? I didn't know the word in Spanish. And we went back and forth, and it turned out that there was not a word at that point in Spanish or Portuguese for entrepreneur. And I thought, no wonder no one's starting a new company. There's not even a word for doing this. And I thought, what if there was an organization to support dreamers who had talent, who had ideas, but didn't have the magic of Silicon Valley around them as a network to support them? And I went back and told everybody at home, and everyone thought this was a terrible idea. And especially my parents. And the first meeting of Endeavor with my co-founder, Peter, took place at my parents' kitchen table. And they overheard us plotting a global organization, and they were not pleased. So my dad gently reminded me that I did not have a trust fund and I would have to be financially independent. And if I didn't want to practice law, what about being a consultant? And when that didn't work, my mother very lovingly suggested that if she was going to have children, I couldn't be getting on all these planes and my eggs were not getting any younger. And what I've been saying this week is that mom was actually ahead of her time because, of course, Apple and Facebook, for better and for worse, obviously just announced the egg freezing program. So mom was ahead of her time. But I remember this moment clearly, and I talk about it in the book as my kitchen table moment, when it's what all dreamers face, is this junction between fear and hope and between doing what is safe and expected and what is unsafe and unknown. And I very clearly remember not only knowing I had to choose that path, but that I would then dedicate my life to helping dreamers who felt similarly alone and scared in that moment, and that I would help them get unscared and unstuck.
And so one of the early defining of the get-going moments was a meeting that you went down to South America for. Why don't you share this meeting? Because it's I actually thought, of the many funny stories in the book, this was one of the ones I really enjoyed, which I didn't know before I read the book.
Really?
Yes.
Wow. It's the Endeavor lore. So we were having trouble getting funding. No one thought this was an idea. So by the way, I should say Endeavor's a nonprofit. So here we're going to support all these, for-profit, big-thinking entrepreneurs, but there was no trust. And we said we had to do a nonprofit because you couldn't at that point do venture capital. You had to build the ecosystem that would support this. So I got a 10-minute meeting with an Argentine real estate entrepreneur named Eduardo Elstein. And he had his largest investor was George Soros. So 5 minutes into our meeting, Eduardo looks at his watch and says, I know you want a meeting with Soros. I'll see what I can do. And I said, no, Eduardo, I'm an entrepreneur. You're an entrepreneur. This is an organization about supporting entrepreneurs. I want your time, your passion, and $200,000. So the meeting had been in English, and he turns to his right-hand guy, and he says, esta chica está loca. And I said back in Spanish that I was very disappointed. This from the man who walked into Soros' office and came out with $10 million. He was lucky I only asked him for $200,000. And so he turned over. I didn't know what he was going to do. And he took out his checkbook. And I walked out of the meeting with the first chairman of Endeavor Argentina, $200,000, and my nickname, La Chica Loca. And that is why I say that crazy is a compliment.
Yes, exactly. The origins of the title of the book. So let's shift a little bit to Endeavor getting big. And so in 2013, Endeavor companies were nearly $7 billion in revenues. Over 400,000 jobs.
Yeah.
But the path of Endeavor itself scaling to a global organization. What are some of the insights that you share with people understanding how kind of global entrepreneurship, the challenges of scaling an organization like Endeavor itself an exercise in entrepreneurship?
Yeah, we learned a lot. I think we had a couple of principles that have stayed true from that napkin at my parents' kitchen table. One was that this wasn't going to be an organization of, by, and for entrepreneurs. And our, you know, we have offices now in 20 countries, and many of our budget, much of our budget is filled with entrepreneurs giving back after they achieve success. We have board members. Actually, one of our entrepreneurs in Egypt is on the board of Endeavor Egypt. This organization is of, by, and for entrepreneurs. That was very helpful. And we told them we didn't have all the answers. I think that when you think about U.S. organizations going into countries, I found them very arrogant. We said, we don't have, first of all, you have to pull us in. We only go to a country if the top business leader said, say, we don't know how to find this young talent of entrepreneurial people. We want a methodology that's proven. We'll bring you in. So before we go, we're not pushing, we're being pulled. And the one time we actually tried to push, and it didn't work, and we actually pulled out because that was a failure. So that's the one thing. The, of my four entrepreneurs, be pushed, be pulled, not pushed. And then early on, I said to the entrepreneurs, look, I'm just starting too. I have no idea. I can't promise you anything. And it was very helpful that one of our first entrepreneurs, who you know, who now lives in the Valley, some of you may know, Wences Casares, was one of the first people I met. And no one had a vision of what an entrepreneur was from a country like Argentina. And Wences had grown up on a sheep farm in Patagonia and had the idea to create the E-Trade of Latin America. 34 investors turned him down. He didn't have the right last name. This was a ridiculous idea. Argentina barely had a functioning stock market. And we selected him. We just knew he had something special. And we helped him get a COO. We helped him raise venture capital. He ended up marrying my assistant, Belle. Endeavor is a full-service organization. And when he sold to Banco Santander for $750 million... Yeah, and now he's on the board.
Yes.
And he sells to Banco Santander for $750 million. And suddenly a spark went off, and people around, not only Buenos Aires, around Latin America said, if he can do it, I can too. And Wences now spends so much of his time mentoring and angel investing in others. And in fact, actually, I don't know if you know this, I was with Peter Thiel and Chicago's Ideas Week last week. And I don't know if I've ever told you this, Reed, but I said, I used to say we're looking for the next Steve Jobs in these markets, and I don't anymore. Mm-hmm. I say we're looking for the next PayPal mafia. Mm-hmm. Because what all of you have done at PayPal by not only creating multiple companies, but going on to mentor, to inspire, to invest in each other, that's what builds ecosystems, and that's what I'm most proud of, is that our entrepreneurs, you can actually map out the connections now, and that's when things are growing.
And how did you, in the getting big, how did you like decide on international selection panels? And how did you make the kind of global connections? Because like one of the stories in your books was this, like who are the names behind, you know, the like who are the names about backing Endeavor? Like is this going to be a serious organization? What were some of the things that were a part of your own entrepreneurial journey in getting big?
Yes, well, so at the beginning, we were just young, four young people that didn't have any last names. And people kept asking who our backers were. We didn't have any backers. So I found out that Peter Brook, the founding father of international venture capital, he created Advent and TA Associates, was speaking at Harvard Business School. So I went, but I knew these HBS kids were going to like go up, running up. So I saw him go to the men's room. And I waited outside, and I pounced when he walked out, and I gave him my card and said, I'd love to come visit you. I have this idea for this organization. You know, it's operating. We'd love to come talk to you because I know you care about entrepreneurs and international activities. And he looked at me and said, who are you and who's supporting this? And I was at HBS, and one of my mentors, but who thought Peter and I were absolutely nuts, is Bill Salmon. He teaches entrepreneurial finance at Harvard. And I said, oh, well, Bill Salmon's a supporter. And Peter Brook said, wait a minute, Salmon's a supporter? Handed me his business card. I go up to Bill's office. I said, Bill, I'm starting a global advisory board, and Peter Brook is going to be the co-chair and would like you to be the other co-chair. 3 years later, on the third anniversary of the Endeavor Global Advisory Board, the two co-chairs realized they had never agreed to anything. And one of my lessons is that stalking is an underrated startup strategy.
Yes, and is a classic entrepreneur strategy, which Endeavor and you deployed magnificently. So last of the sections is going home, which is mostly about how you integrate your own personal life, the kind of the psychic mission, the question of integrating who you are into what you're doing. How does that fit for you in Endeavor?
I had to learn, first of all, I didn't know I was a leader at first. So I tell a story of actually being fired by that assistant Bell who Wences married early on because I had forgotten to pay payroll. And I was so excited because I think it was Endeavor's first case study at Harvard Business School was being taught, and I wanted to tell her. And she said, Linda, you forgot to authorize payroll, and your employees have to pay rent. I said, employees? I don't have employees. We're team members. I'm sure someone else paid it. Now can I tell you my story? And she said, you're the CEO. You're the only one who's authorized. And I realized, oh, my God, I have to become a leader. And then I thought, okay, how does one become a leader if I have employees now instead of team members? And I thought, especially as a woman, I had to be more independent, I had to be stronger, I had to be more self-sufficient, and I had to separate my work and my family. And so what happened, and I have been very open about this, is that I have identical twins. If that's not chaotic enough, my husband, Bruce Feiler, who's a journalist, and one of his books was called Walking the Bible, so he was known as the walking guy. He got a diagnosis 6 years ago of bone cancer. And our girls were three, and this was right when Endeavor, I see someone from the Omidyar Network, Endeavor had just gotten a $10 million investment to double the number of countries, and I knew I wasn't getting on any planes. I was going to go to every chemotherapy session. We knew he was going to have a 17-hour surgery to replace his femur. And when I wasn't with him, I was going to be with the girls, making sure they were stable. So I told the board and I told the team. And what never surprised me is that Endeavor more than met its goals. That I expected. Here's what surprised me. When I came back, I had changed. And I was much more open about what was going on with Bruce, with the girls, that I couldn't hold it all together. I talked about my struggles. And two team members came up to me and they said, you know, Linda, we always admired you, but we thought you were superhuman. And not in a good way, they meant in an unrelatable way. And they said, now that we know who you really are, now we'll follow you anywhere. And the lesson that I took, and I write about this in the book, is that we always think as leaders we're supposed to be superhuman. And really the lesson I learned is less super, more human.
So one of the things in my own books when I've written them that people have said to me is that you're crazy as an entrepreneur for writing a book, right? Because you should be starting companies, you should be hiring people, you should be running an organization, etc. So what got you to writing the book? What made you push off this cliff? Because writing a book is a tremendous amount of work.
Yes. In fact, you've mentored me through this whole process. I'm obviously married to a writer, but I'm married to a writer. So I've come to believe that entrepreneur is a fancy word for saying you're a doer. And knowing that a fellow thinker but doer was writing it, that was incredibly inspirational for me. So thank you. I have worked with 1,000 entrepreneurs now around the world. And I knew that Endeavor works not with startups, but with scale-ups. And so I knew that we had some lessons about entrepreneurs at that moment that I could share, but it didn't seem like a book to me. And so I always avoided when people say, are you going to write the Endeavor story, are you going to write about entrepreneurs? I said, no. And then something strange started happening to me a few years ago, which is I started getting calls from people inside Fortune 500 companies saying, I need help. My job is not safe, but I don't know how to be a change maker. Can you help me think more like an entrepreneur? And then I got called by people at my daughter's school, parents saying, I'm going through a work transition. I don't know. I've never done something on my own. Can you help me think through this? And so I really came to realize that entrepreneurship is not just for entrepreneurs anymore. And I wanted to try to mine my 20 years of experience to see if I could create a roadmap for anyone with a dream, but anyone, as I said, who's feeling stuck. Good Morning America last week called me the entrepreneur whisperer. But what I like, what I think is, I like getting dreamers unstuck. So that's when I felt like I have to write this.
And so, as part of explaining why entrepreneurship is for everyone, you engage in a bit of zoology, right? Because you essentially categorize them into four different beasts.
My own species.
Yes. Which was, I had never thought of entrepreneurs as various forms of the bestiary, but it was extremely good language. Would you like to go through the gazelles, skunks, you know, butterflies, and dolphins?
I would. You know, okay, let me tell you. So when I started, first of all, let me go back to the fact that there was no word in Spanish or in Portuguese. Well, 5 years into Endeavor, we got a call from the editor of the Brazilian Portuguese dictionary saying, in part because of Endeavor's work, they were adding emprendedor into the lexicon. So that was a very cool day. But entrepreneur is a clunky word, let's face it. And then when you start adding qualifiers like intrapreneur and social entrepreneur, and we talk about high impact entrepreneur, it gets even clunkier.
Mompreneur,
yeah. Copreneur, kidpreneur. Yeah. Ah! So I sort of thought, all right, I want to reach out to different people. I want people to understand you don't need a hoodie to be an entrepreneur. And we're going to talk about different sources, different lessons, but also different case studies in the book. And so I wanted a way in, and so I had come up with this term, skunks, that I love, that's the intrapreneur, that's, and it's named partly after Lockheed Martin's Skunk Works program, famously in formed fighter jets. But I honestly believe that you need to stink up the joint. If you're working in a big company, your job, Michael Dell has told me that there are two people today, the quick and the dead. And so I really believe that people inside companies need to give themselves permission to take some risks. So I wanted, a lot of the stories are about the skunks. The gazelle was a term that existed. David Birch, the economist, talked about the high growth entrepreneurs as gazelles. So that's pretty typical. Most of the Endeavor entrepreneurs are gazelles. The butterflies are the formerly known as mom and pops. But there are people who aim, like butterflies, for independence and freedom, and there are many hundred, you know, thousands and thousands of kinds of butterflies, and it turns out that 4 out of 10 Americans, you know, will spend part of their careers working for themselves. And more people who would have been mom and pops, and you don't need these skills, they need to think and act like entrepreneurs. Yep. The guy at the farmer's market has an inn at Whole Foods and is taking, you know, Square readers, so you have to have these skills. And the last is dolphins. It's really the social entrepreneurs. And dolphins are known as the most cooperative of the animals, but if you harm their pod or their environment, watch out.
Well, and dolphins were your first job with Ashoka.
With Ashoka.
As part of being a dolphin.
Yes, exactly. And now I get asked a lot about Shark Tank, and would I be on Shark Tank? I said, I'd be the dolphin in the Shark Tank.
Yeah, I think you would be.
I'd be a shark.
Yes, exactly. All right.
Fair enough.
Yes. Yes. Well, you would be a very large dolphin, pushing the other sharks aside, protecting the entrepreneurs. And so let's talk a little bit about getting going. So one of the things that you identified is that the key thing is for entrepreneurs to give themselves the permission to think big, right? Because it's not like while they may. Yeah, permission from your spouse, permission from your boss, permission from your co-founders, all that is important. The self-permission is important. Part of the thing that's interesting is you get to where the difference between madness and genius, right? Mm-hmm. Because in self-permission, you want to tend statistically or shots on goal to genius. It's always risky, and we'll get to risk because that's one of the key things. But talk a little bit about where people should give themselves the self-permission and how they should do that with realism. Like, how do they distinguish for themselves self-permission that's an intelligent self-permission?
I would have thought, first of all, when I started, I would have thought that the barriers to entrepreneurship were financial, that they were structural or that people should hold themselves back more. And it's the opposite. I've come to believe that most good ideas do not die in the marketplace or in the conference room or in the laboratory. They die in the people's minds who never get them off the ground to begin with. And the thing that holds people back is they don't give themselves permission. They're waiting for someone, whether it's the boss or their parent or their spouse. And I know this in my own life, but I've told people also here in the U.S., we overplan, we overthink, we overstrategize. And I've told people, so you've got to stop planning, start doing. And I think that there's enough realism in the market. Like, once you get your idea off, I feel like you get feedback pretty soon, whether you ask for it or not, whether there'll be enough time to know whether your crazy idea really is crazy or you should go forward. But you've got people hold themselves back because they're worried other people will think they're nuts. And every innovator, whether it was Henry Ford was crazy Henry, Jack Ma, who just took Alibaba public, was known as crazy Jack. But also the Microsoft team that created the Xbox, they were laughed at by their colleagues who said they were creating coffin box. And so every good idea, I feel like if you're disrupting the status quo, if you're rocking the boat, you're going to be told you're off your rocker. And it is amazing how many people psych themselves out. So I think they've, and the other thing is,
and actually, you have a good line in the book, which is you should psych yourself up versus psych yourself out.
Exactly. Yeah. And then pretty soon enough, the realism will hit. There's time for realism at the beginning. A little fantasy is okay.
Yeah.
Because part of it is you're reimagining the world not as it is, but as it should be.
Yep. And actually, part of how I think about that point a little bit is you should go talk to anyone who might possibly have, we'll get to the plus minuses of friends in a bit, but anyone who might have good insight. And then you should think hard about it, but you shouldn't necessarily take it as gospel. You should hold on to that belief that you have, but it's kind of like this flexible persistence. It's not just no matter what your idea is,
right?
You know, kind of dream,
yes,
act, but then also be getting the feedback.
I totally agree. I love your term, flexible persistence. Yes.
So one of the myths that that I thought you wrote very eloquently about was that people always think about entrepreneurs as the bet the house risk takers. The, you know, put it all on, you know, the number, roll the dice, roll the roulette wheel, try to make it happen.
So one of the things I've realized, I think being, look, you're in San Francisco, you're near Silicon Valley, you're in the heart of entrepreneurship. One of the problems with talking only about the Mark Zuckerbergs and the Elon Musks is it really discourages as many people as it encourages. And I think partly people say, well, I'm not a risk taker. I'm not going to bet the farm. And I have a mortgage and kids. I can't do this entrepreneurship thing. So here's the thing. It turns out entrepreneurs are risk minimizers. They're not risk maximizers. And some of the things I looked into that actually surprised me were, one, half the Inc. 500 companies were started with $5,000 or less. And with crowdfunding and crowdsourcing, both to get the feedback, get initial customers in to fund it, you don't need millions of dollars. You don't need venture capital to start a company.
Wait, I shouldn't be nodding at that one.
And the second thing is that many of the companies, you know, I believe that at some point you have to go all in. At some point, if you want to go big, we can talk about that later. But at the beginning, you do not. And some of the best innovators start off with only one foot in the door and protect their jobs. So Sarah Blakely of Spanx, many of us are very familiar with her products. She spent 2 years selling fax machines before she knew her idea was going to take off. Spanx is now a $1 billion company or more. And Phil Knight of Nike, the guy who's the Just Do It guy, he spent almost a decade doing other people's taxes. Someone else sold the sneakers while he did people's taxes on the side. And so what I realized is you can wager a few chickens, but you don't have to bet the farm.
Do you have a definition for entrepreneur that you most like? Is it doer or is it something else?
I believe, I think it is simplicity. I think, look, I think a lot of people can dream, but to be able to execute on those dreams and to actually do, I think that is the essence.
It's one of them tends to be the whose plans outstrip their current assets. But actually, in fact, and it's a little bit like, because we're now going to move a little bit to your categorization of the different kinds of entrepreneurs, which is another. So first you had a bestiary, and now we have, it's not really all, while diamonds is the common, it's not all stones, but another categorization. I actually think that one of the things that was kind of central about how you were thinking about this was essentially how entrepreneurs actually, in fact, are vision the world to be different than it is. Mm-hmm. It's like, and this is the diamond of the, here's how I see the world different than it is today, and that's what I'm driving to. But that's one of the four types. So will you share with our folks the four types?
Yeah, well, the other thing is, so, again, many of the examples I actually use are inside companies. You know, guy at Pfizer, who is a mid-level HR executive, who gets frustrated that his team members are not going home to tuck their kids into bed. Instead, they're doing kind of menial work. He's like, shouldn't we be able to handle that, you know, and outsource it? He does not ask permission from the boss to get started. He doesn't. He's a very limited budget, and he starts this little outsourcing program in India for his coworkers. And the first bombs, and he gets feedback, it's not working. And then he tests it, and he spends a year, and eventually goes to somebody in a different department to give him a little budget and a little cover. A year later, they go with proof points, not PowerPoints, to the boss, and they suddenly have a number of people who will put their budgets against this outsourcing program. Today, PfizerWorks is used by 10,000 employees, including the CEO, and is considered the best program. So someone like him is not necessarily thinking like the next Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. And working in so many different countries and so many different industries with entrepreneurs, what I started realizing is people were modeling themselves after what they thought the entrepreneur was going to be, especially when they had to convert to leaders, especially when they wanted to take their idea big. And so I actually started working first with the team at Endeavor, then we brought in Bain and created this classification scheme based on the 1,000 entrepreneurs we've seen. We've given them this test. The Wall Street Journal published this article. It's now, if you go on lindarotenberg.com, all of you can take the test. But there are four basic personality types. One is the diamond. These are the people that are excited about the new thing. And everyone, I should say, has strengths and weaknesses. The second are the people who are very brand-focused. They're the trendsetters. They're people more like Oprah Winfrey or Richard Branson. And they are people who believe that they can create a great customer experience, but based on brands, they can be one man or one woman shows. There are people who are much more mission-driven, and whether they're actually doing something social, like a Blake Mycoskie or Tom's, or whether they're Howard Schultz. When Howard Schultz describes Starbucks, he talks about the mission. He talks about sort of social and environmental values first, and they want to transform old industries. And then the last are the rocket ships, and they are very metrics-oriented. And Jeff Bezos is the perfect example of this. He has metrics meetings at Amazon. And in fact, there's this great story that he, unlike all the other companies in the Valley in Seattle that are giving all the perks and the foosball and the massages, he gave nothing freeway. You have to pay for parking at Amazon. And he, the only thing he gave free was aspirin. But after they had a bad, it's true, after they had a bad earnings call like today, like one of the days like today, the analyst, out went the free aspirin. So I said, rocket ships have formidable minds, but they give those around them headaches.
Very funny. So let's move to
the point is that what I tell entrepreneurs is don't model yourself after someone else. Yes. Find out your own leadership style. Surround yourself with people who can complement your strengths and you know, you'll know some of your weaknesses, but that's when you want to go big, you have to know yourself so then you can surround yourself with others around you.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I mean, the entrepreneurship categorization, as you mentioned in the book, is part of the whole key thing is if everyone held up Steve Jobs as the only role model, you would have very little entrepreneurship because it's a very unique type.
Exactly.
Whereas there's room for everyone pursuing entrepreneurship, both for their own lives and also for different kinds of leadership in companies, creation of companies, and it's just like understand what the playbook is and go do that.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I talked about my own experience. You know, I thought Jack Welch and, you know, I thought when you have leader, you have people in mind. I think it's so liberating. And I think that's what I wanted to give people the sense that it is possible that entrepreneurship is, as I said, not just for entrepreneurs, it's for everyone, but that you can find your own style, your own ideas, and make it work. You don't have to shoot the moon, and you don't have to be the next Steve Jobs, and you can be an entrepreneur.
One of the things when I was reading about skunks, because skunks are the entrepreneurs. I was about to not use the word, but I guess it is a word in the parlance. Is part of the thing, the talk that I give when I give to business schools is I say two things are negative factors in investing, an MBA and a background in management consulting. And I remembered that when I was reading that section of the book because part of the whole thing is don't try to create a business plan Don't try to create a PowerPoint.
Yes.
Do something. Use the results. And there was another section, because frequently people think entrepreneurship, business plan. You also had some fun things to say about business plans. So
Yes. No, stop planning, start doing. Yes, I include a section on what business plans really mean that actually that former mentor who I stalked, Bill Salmon, wrote, which is hilarious about how they just reverse engineer everything anyway. But one of the other skunk stories I tell is the story of two moms inside Clorox. And they are job sharing. And in fact, they work 2.5 days a week. And their names are Suzanne and Mary Jo. They end up merging their name into Sam so that you whichever one of them you get, you always get Sam. Yeah. And
Suzanne and Mary Jo.
Yes.
Sam.
So thank you. So, but because they're actually moms, they're getting feedback on the playground from actual customers of Clorox who want eco-friendly products. So again, they don't run to the boss, they don't create a business plan, they start testing products inside their company, they then team up with some other skunks inside Clorox who are chemists, they name their group because it's eco-friendly products, Project Kermit, because it's not easy being green, and a year later they have a product line. That's when they go to the bosses, and Clorox Greenworks is now a $60 million a year line. But again, all these stories found similar patterns of people who, whether they're inside a company or outside, they're giving themselves permission, and then they're doing their idea, testing it out, getting the iterative feedback, and then going when something's a little bit more baked.
So let's shift to going big, which is the next section. A lot of what Endeavor does is try to help understand the patterns of the four types of entrepreneurs, the patterns of scale-up. Maybe one of the things to start in the going big is kind of the role of friends, right? So classically is, you get all your friends and angels and you should listen to them and they should be allies. It's not quite that simple. Would you like to start with
Yes. Well, we are very familiar with the phrase, friends don't let friends drive drunk. So my phrase is friends don't let friends test drive their ideas. Because they're either going to tell you one or two things. It's like it's like taking them to a bridal fitting, the last bridal fitting, and expecting them to say anything other than, you look perfect, and that's a genius idea. Or they're going to tell you, this is the worst idea ever. You're going to put yourself in bankruptcy. You're never going to be able to put your kids college. This is actually what happens to the founders of Banana Republic. The founders of Banana Republic go to some friends with these sketches, these quirky sketches. And one was a cartoon reporter. And they have this idea for this kind of funky, outdoors wear. But it's based on these catalogs. And their friends look at them and they said, you can't send this out. They almost don't take it off the printing press. When Gap buys Banana Republic, it's because of these quirky letters. And their friends almost discourage them. And in fact, a group of researchers in Spain and the U.S. asked founders their one regret. And this was surprising to me. The number one regret is they told friends and family too soon. That's why I'm a big fan of crowdsourcing and crowdfunding, because then you actually can find real customers for what you're doing, but you don't rely on your friends and family too early.
And what are your other kind of lessons from going big? I mean, one of the other ones that may surprise people is firing your mother-in-law.
Yes. I believe you have to get a startup prenup. And I believe this because what's true in the U.S. is true, what we've seen all around the world. Most people start companies with their friends or their family. Forget about telling them about your ideas. Most of them are co-founders. And we see so many examples now. I was just with three African-American moms in Prospect Heights, and they set up this bakery. They had actually crowdfunded the bakery. Three co-CEOs. I was like, okay, there can only be one boss. This is not going to work. And what happens is everyone says, but I don't want to formalize this relationship because it's my in-law or my friend. And what happens is at some point the interests no longer align, and either somebody wants a lifestyle business and somebody wants to go big, or someone's skills no longer matches up with what the company needs, and it becomes even more awkward. So structure is your friend, the prenup is your friend, and what I say is the other half of firing your mother-in-law is then you can still show up for family dinner.
Yes, exactly. Anything, leadership 3.0. Going big, that's another important theme here. So I would, funny thing, of course, here in the Valley, we frequently use 2.0 all the time. 3.0 is probably the first time I've actually seen that written in a book. So talk about leadership 3.0.
I think, we talked a little bit about my own journey and becoming, just more authentic in who I am. But I think that I get asked a lot about millennials today. And I think that this whole notion of leadership and ideas being generated from the top and coming down and office hours and senior management meetings. I was asked the other day, what was my worst mistake? And I said, convening senior management meetings, where we then had meetings about meetings and people would be on chatter why we weren't what we were doing. One of our teammates was here who convinced us all to join chatter. And I said, forget these senior management meetings. And I think that making yourself more accessible, I think that making yourself not awesome but flawsome and owning your own strengths, but realizing also, I think that today to keep employees, it's not enough to have a steady paycheck. It's not enough to have these perks. You have to give them psychic equity. Millennials especially, but I think everybody wants meaning and purpose and vision. And I think unless as a leader you are thinking about your own culture and how everyone understands the mission you're trying to do and is having an impact in their specific role and connected to de-siloed and connected to what you're doing, you're not going to be able to attract talent today. And there was a study of 12,000 millennials that came out this year, and they asked them to rank their top 25 places to work. Over half were hospitals and government agencies. I couldn't believe this. And sitting at number one, above Google, Amazon, Disney, I don't know if LinkedIn was on the list, it should be, definitely, but St. Jude Children's Hospital. So I think today, if leaders don't realize that people, forget about leadership, it's employeeship. And I mean, you talk about these tours of duty, employers' conference that we use at Endeavor. And you're not going to keep people forever, but you've got to focus on their own career path and make them feel like you're looking out for them as human beings first and not just what they can do for your company.
So one of the things, and this is, I think, applicable to this is one of the places where entrepreneurship is applicable to more than just people starting companies. But we're shifting a little bit to the going home, and you have some very funny lines about balance. Because people are frequently like, how do you maintain balance? What's the, you know, and would you care to share your own views on balance?
I don't like that term. I think that it's very stressful, that I think nothing is ever in balance. And I think that the way I look at it is work-life integration. And I think that as long as the last chapter of the book is written as a letter to my daughters, Eden and Tybee, because I try to be there as much as I can, and I every time I think I'm doing great and I'm saying no to all these work things, then I'll be home brushing. They'll be brushing their teeth, and I'll like get out my smartphone, and they'll say, "Mommy, mommy, mommy," in her emails. And then they told me once that I can be an entrepreneur for a short time, but I am a mommy forever. And I take that to heart. I say no, almost as much as I can to things that will get me on planes. But I wanted them to know what I did with my life. And I think all of us need our kids to know what it is that we're passionate about. The best thing I did about writing this book was write that letter, and then I actually read the audio tape and thought, how great is it that my great-grandchildren one day will hear me telling their grandparents, my daughters, what their mother was doing and why I lived the life I did. If all of us did that, I think we sometimes underestimate what our kids can take from us. And just when we think they're not listening, they are. And the funny story that goes back to leadership is I had to learn how to fire people. I was not very good at that initially. And one day, I didn't think I ever brought it home, or my girls were then about 5 or 6, and they were playing office with some friends, and somebody was getting sacked. And Tybee, one of my daughters, looks at her friend and says, "Well, actually, my mommy doesn't fire people. She tells them they'll be happier elsewhere."
Yes, she right sizes is yes. Although management consulting jokes are inappropriate in an entrepreneurship setting, but yes. So let's shift a little bit to some of the topics bridging between the book, which is the last theme on the book for question, and then to a little bit to Silicon Valley and global. So chaos. So it's not a surprise to Silicon Valley entrepreneurs to say there are great opportunities in chaos, right?
Yes.
It's the transformation of technology changes, it changes in markets,
exactly.
It's interconnectivity, it's new things. However, you've not only taken all of those observations about chaos, but you've also made it into an acronym, which is somewhat of a playbook for thinking about how to do entrepreneurship.
Yeah. Yeah, and it is true that here people are not surprised, but I am around this country. People forget that half the Fortune 500 companies were started during periods of downturn and recession. I think there's this sense we crave stability here, and there's always a sense if the stock market goes down, oh my God, this is the worst time to take any risk, whether you're in a company or starting out. When really, I mean, that I've learned working in Egypt and in Greece during its crisis and Argentina during its crisis, and that stability favors the status quo and that disruption favors the entrepreneur and that you have to make chaos your friend. And in fact, but my favorite story in the book doesn't come from one of the Endeavor examples. It actually comes from the early 1800s in France, and it's my most favorite story, and it involves a young widow named Barbe Nicole Ponsardin. And she inherits, when her husband dies, a small family winery in northeastern France. So she's basically put in charge of a business she knows nothing about and proceeds to revolutionize the industry. So she creates a method where you store the bottles upside down, you freeze the excess yeast off, and it creates that sharp, sparkling wine we drink today. Her 1811 vintage is said to be the first truly modern champagne. But just as Barbe Nicole has perfected this process, the Russians invade, and all the experienced wine owners shutter their doors. Barbe Nicole spots a marketing opportunity and resolves to get the Russian army wasted. Always a good technique. And this strategy works well, and she decides to make a very smart bet, a strategic risk, and run the blockades. She knows peace is coming, but the treaty hasn't been signed yet. She gets her bottles just outside of St. Petersburg in Moscow, and when that occurs, when peace is signed, she gets her bottles, beats out the competitors, and Tsar Alexander declares he will drink only the widow. Veuve is the French for widow, and Barbe Nicole's late husband was François Clicquot. It is the story of Veuve Clicquot. And by embracing the turbulence around her and taking these smart risks and doing, she becomes the first woman to run a multinational. I thought, how great is that story? And what better proof that you don't need a hoodie to be an entrepreneur? Yes.
And for that, we should have champagne. In a few minutes, we're going to take questions from the audience. The question should be for Linda. They should not be your own life story. And they should focus on Linda, Endeavor, and the work.
Can I say one thing?
Oh, of course.
I have a whole section about mentors.
You can start lining up is the short thing.
I just want to end here that I have a whole section about how there's no longer one soulmate as your mentor, that also was very stressful. I was like, oh my God, I have to find a husband and a soulmate. This is true. That you should get a circle of mentors and that you should think about mentoring as 360 degrees. And some people should be your friends. You can have your frenemies. You can have people younger than you and older than you. And I just wanted to say, Reed, who is a friend, who is a board member, but throughout this whole process, you have also been a mentor, and I want to just thank you publicly for all the support you've given.
It's been an honor and a privilege to share the lessons. So last question from me. So one of the things, Silicon Valley is obviously an intense, kind of leading ecosystem of entrepreneurship. There's a specialized set of things that we do here. People frequently don't realize how fortunate we are to be in this network. They think that's because we're all geniuses, but actually, there's actually a lot in the network that's super helpful. What would you say are the lessons from looking around global entrepreneurship? Because you find stunning people all over the world. That's part of what the Endeavor selection panels are about.
Yes.
Say a little bit about the global entrepreneurs for the Silicon Valley, listeners.
Yeah, there are lots of talented people with lots of big ideas and who for decades and centuries couldn't get their ideas off the ground. Now they can. I think Alibaba is a taste of what's coming. And I think that two things are happening. I think one is people are realizing that there are global markets outside of Silicon Valley and that maybe some of the ideas could emerge from those markets. I think especially when we get to smartphones taking over, so many people in Latin America and Africa and Europe grew up on, that was their one device, that was everything. That's how they pay for things, that's how they phone. It's our fifth device, right? I think that a lot of first-class innovations are gonna be imported here from abroad. You're gonna start seeing that. But the other thing is this ecosystem effect. We at Endeavor talk about the scale up, not the startup. We think most policy focuses either on inane things like how many days it takes to start a business. Doesn't make a difference. Turns out if it's 3 days, 33, or 300, entrepreneurs will find a way around it. It doesn't matter even how many incubators and accelerators and startups there are. What matters is businesses that have gotten some traction or are family businesses being taken over by the next generation, if you can help them at that point, it's where you can unlock the job creation and the wealth creation, but then getting those people to give back and to see their role feeding that ecosystem, that pay it forward, that is key. And the thing I'm most proud of is that Endeavor entrepreneurs feel that they were supported and they had a duty to pay it forward. And we're actually now mapping out the growth of these ecosystems, the PayPal Mafia effect going global.
Yes, although, by the way, I always try to correct people to PayPal Network because the mafia thing is not quite the right connotation.
Own it. Own crazy. Own mafia. Own it.
All right. And with that, our first question.
Dolphins.
Love
and,
that.
And bring entrepreneurship to government. Now,
yes.
My question is, 99% of the people I ask this question to and give information to don't provide any feedback. And so I get less than 1% feedback, but I get lots and lots of photographs with them. I was hoping that I could get a one-page snail mail feedback from you on this big idea, and that's all I can ask.
Well, that is very specific. I don't mind being stalked. A one-page request. Now, that is very specific. I would be happy to give some feedback. I do believe that government needs dolphins, or if not butterflies, in there. And I talk about how actually the FAA changed the way it recruited talent, that it was having so much trouble recruiting people because people thought it was a boring state government agency. They were recruiting teenagers to be their air traffic controllers because they couldn't get anyone out of college. And the head of HR said, wait a minute, we are the backbone of the US of A. We, and being part of this helps change aviation. They changed their messaging, and now they're actually an employer of choice. So I do applaud your idea. Can't promise the one page, but we'll promise to look at it. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Irene Fair. And what I loved about when you spoke about leadership and how important it is to know yourself and to find your own style. So
yes.
I'm curious, what advice do you have for women around finding their own leadership style and especially entrepreneurial women?
I hope that if you do read Creatives as a Compliment, you will see how many examples there are of so many women. And one of the reasons I wanted to tell the stories, I think we limit ourselves by telling the same stories over and over. I think, as I said, it discourages as many people. So I tell stories of men and women and different, but I did, the ones that I kept coming back to, I was surprised, were the stories of Estée Lauder and Veuve Clicquot and the woman who's created Pepperidge Farm because her son had a childhood allergy and they didn't have gluten-free bread at the time. That's how Pepperidge Farm was started. I never knew these stories, so I wanted to tell them to give people encouragement. What I would say is, number one, authenticity. People want that. Number two, women, one of the things I found, if you want your team to be entrepreneurial, you have to promote failure. Well, people say that, but really, how do they do that? And one of the things I looked at was how you inculcated that. So Ratan Tata of India, the largest conglomerate, actually has a prize for the best failed idea. How great is that? But so many of my leadership comes from parenting. And so I actually think the more networked we are, the more you need to get people and not just have ideas come from the top. I actually think that women's leadership styles are going to be very well suited both to entrepreneurship and to leadership. So I tried to give a roadmap for people to find their own. And what I would say is what I had to learn, which was very tough, is just be true to yourself.
By the way, the two things I'd add is you're promoting intelligent, risky shots on goal and learning.
Yes.
That's what it is. People frequently say, no, it's not that you failed that's good. It was that it was a smart shot on goal. And you learn.
Yeah, it's not about celebrating failure, yeah. But if you don't give people that permission that they're not going to lose, they think they're going to lose their job, and they
yes.
won't give themselves any permission to try, right?
Okay, well, thanks for speaking, and I hope this is on topic. One thing I picked up from the talk is the idea that everybody should be an entrepreneur, which is something I really support. I really love that idea. However, now with Uber hiring drivers kind of as contractors and the 1099 economy and making them essentially entrepreneurs, there's coming up this struggle that maybe they shouldn't be entrepreneurs because they're essentially employees and, the labor is not good for them. So what is your perspective on that? I mean, do you think they should be entrepreneurs? Do you think there's a time where we say, no, you can't be an entrepreneur anymore?
Look, I think that everyone needs to think and act like an entrepreneur, but a lot of what I talk about with the skunks are people inside companies. Not everyone has to start their own business. But I really believe in what I wrote in the letter to my girls at the end, is that I think all of us, and this gets to Reed's tours of duty, we're no longer to have the career path my dad had. We're not going to stay in one organization our entire career. And I think people are going to come in and out of the private sector and government or nonprofits, working for other people, working for themselves. I think what we need is a skill set that allows us to view the world differently and to act on that and to reinvent ourselves. And I think that if we have that skill set for reinvention, no matter where we are in our career trajectory, and I think people are you know, during the parenting years and other things phase in and phase out, that will be what serves us well. So I think it's great, you know, when McDonald's employees often go on to become entrepreneurs themselves. And they will say that franchising experience or that experience first, that's what gave them their start. So maybe that will happen with people. You hear it with Airbnb, right? People are able to be entrepreneurs because they have some rent and they see themselves then. So I'm okay with people at Uber.
Hi. So my name's Emily Baum. I'm a female founder. I've just discovered that I'm half star, half diamond.
Oh, you took the test.
Yeah,
I love it.
I'm struggling with which one is more.
Okay, I love that.
But my question is, so you were labeled, Loca Lady, and I think if you're someone with a big dreamer, that's often something that happens, right? People start to perceive you in a certain way. And so you've worked with so many entrepreneurs, and you yourself have gone through this. Particularly as a woman, as a dreamer, how do you still make people take you seriously and realize that you've got something behind that? Because I think there is that tendency that it could just be you're Loca, right? So what strategies do you have for
Connect? Yeah, when we went to the Middle East, the name carried over. I used to care. And then I realized at some point the numbers spoke for themselves. The idea spoke for itself. And I think the more confident I became, the more I would say, I'm sorry, I'm going to my girls' ballet recital. I'm not going in. In fact, I spoke at Goldman Sachs last year. Oh, it's radio. I spoke at an unnamed Wall Street firm last year.
And
A leading Wall Street firm. Yes, that shall go unnamed. And before I spoke to the firm, I was asked to speak to the top 50 women. And I said, of course. And they said to me, you know, we noticed you talk about Tybee and Eden in your impact reports. We're so surprised because we will not put photos of our children on our desks for fear of being disloyal to the firm. And so a half an hour went by, and they were asking all these tips on entrepreneurship and scams and whatever, and they said, do you have any advice? I said, yeah, put your family photos out. And so I think that so many of us, as I said, for me, the more I owned who I was authentically, the more I allowed myself to embrace the crazy and embrace being different and wear color and not try to fit in and talk about my girls, the more not only was I myself, so I felt more, but then I felt like, you know what, they're either going to like me or they're not, but my idea will live on its own. And it gave me, it liberated me and gave me even more confidence than when I was pretending to be something I wasn't.
Thank you.
Hi, Steve Collins, entrepreneur. Thank you for your talk, Lyndon Reed. Wonderful topic. Entrepreneurship, the classic question, are you born with it or can you be taught it?
So I used to believe that you were born, and I've completely changed. As I said, I think it's a skill set and a mindset. And I knew the person I look to in this is Julia Child, who basically said that French cooking, that everyone thought, if you don't go to the Cordon Bleu and you're not born in France, you can't, that anyone can master the art of French cooking. And it just takes a little instruction and a little practice. I do not believe everyone is going to lead a company to an IPO. I do not believe everyone is going to be a household name, nor do I believe everyone is going to be a founder. But and I believe that's actually something in your if you don't constitutionally in your gut have the ability to hire and fire people, you shouldn't do that. You should maybe be an entrepreneur within an organization. But I actually believe this is a skill set and a mindset that can be learned. You may disagree with this answer, but
actually, I think it's like many false dichotomies. It's both, right? So. You can work hard, and if you're not naturally through a lot of work, you can be much better at it. Now, if you have zero of the capabilities, like you really can't deal with conflict, you can't deal with uncertainty, you can't deal with pivoting and constant changes, That makes starting a company harder constitutionally, and so learning the nurture skills. On the other hand, I don't think there's anyone who's just born as an entrepreneur. There's a whole set of skills that you need to learn in order to make this
right.
happen.
But I think, again, back to the people getting intimidated. So I talk a lot about minivation, mini innovation, and that you don't have to shoot the moon necessarily. Many of our best companies started with minivation. So let me just tell you one story. I know you're all standing there, but the story that I start the book with is actually a woman who grew up in the slums of Rio. Her name is Leila Velez, and she grew up, her mother was a maid, her father a janitor. She gets a job at McDonald's. Her sister-in-law is a hairdresser. And Leila says, you know, poor people deserve to feel beautiful too. And I'm frustrated that there aren't enough products for the curly-haired, you know, population that I know. And she convinces her sister-in-law to team up. They set up a mad scientist lab in their basement. And they test their first products on her husband. The husband's hair falls out. And we meet them, and they had one salon, but we knew they had something. They were not born entrepreneurs. Today, their company, Beleza Natural, serves 100,000 clients a month, employs 3,000 people, and generates over $100 million a year. Would anyone have thought they were naturally entrepreneurs, but they just kept going?
Thank you. Hi there. Thank you. Also for your talk. You touched on this topic, but this is sort of a quandary for me. So I have been an entrepreneur,
yes,
with big companies my whole career, and sort of am like a budding entrepreneur at the moment. And from day one, I felt like I wanted a partner. And then I sort of got advice on both sides of like, yeah, whether, you know, and this is really sort of a vision I've had for 15 years, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just curious from your experience and some of the other, like in the lean startup model, you know,
yes,
I sat in a room with one of those leaders and they say like, you know, if there's a single founder, forget it. You know, you'll never succeed. And so I'm curious from your, and I've sort of built the circle of mentorship. Like,
yes,
I'm doing well on that. But I have not found the partner. And I'm curious your experience on like, is it okay to just have that circle of wonderful, amazing people around you? Or should you really have that partner that's, you know, sweating and spending and doing it all with
you? I would say I don't think there's a should. I've seen it work both ways. I've seen a lot of partnerships work very well, but there's one clear leader. I, as I said, every time there's three co-CEOs, I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is going to rest.
Yeah.
And so I think that as long as someone is clearly in the lead, and then I actually do like these personalities because you have to understand what the strengths and weaknesses are and how you balance each other out. But I've also seen as you can be a sole founder, and that doesn't mean you're one woman or one man show. Right, and so you can create the talent, you know, around you and in different positions. I don't know if you have different, but so I've seen it work both ways. It's what's organic to you and to the specific project.
But you always have to identify someone as a CEO. But the co-founder is all the hands are on the steering wheel, right? So that doesn't mean that the non-CEO co-founder isn't extremely and foundationally important. It just ultimately part of the CEO thing is effective decisions,
yes,
which risks you take, you know, that's why, and you should come to that clarity.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, my name's Jenny Yang, and it's an honor and privilege to hear both of you speaking right now. This is extremely inspirational. So, essentially, I can empathize with you, Linda, because I am that person who's going to be that stalker and give you my business card, because I literally came here. That was my main objective, to give both of you my business card.
Oh, your main objective to come was to stalk me?
I already did stalk you on LinkedIn. I did all my LinkedIn due diligence and
That's
read
fabulous.
Some of your articles. In any case, so in terms of some of the problems that I'm facing, so I am that ex-consultant that you can actually make fun of, but I have reinvented myself as it relates to my career path. It's been a very organic career path, and I think the reason why I left my two previous employers is due to management. And management in the sense that they couldn't engage me with the opportunities in terms of where I wanted to grow functionally. Yep. And that's essentially what I am going through right now. I am at a male top heavy startup, and essentially I feel as if my opportunities to grow vertically as well as functionally are being mitigated. And so essentially my question to you is how as a female, or just generally, male or female, you know, how do you overcome that? Because I too have a very independent and strong background, but
yes,
I can understand why females are driven out.
Yeah, I've personally seen this issue less as a male-female thing and more as a generational thing. I really do. I've had to change the way people, young people come into our organization. I think the expectations have changed. I think now boomers and Gen X people want the same thing, but I think millennials really sort of were the ones to say, hey, wait a minute, from the beginning, excuse me, I don't want to be in this little silo. I need to know what's going on in the whole organization, and I'd like to weigh in on that decision. And for people coming from traditions, like, wait a minute, what are you talking about? And I think management consulting firms are still, they view themselves as partnerships, and that's very dangerous. I think people who think of themselves as very democratic, meritocratic, mm-hmm. have a harder time actually helping the younger people get decision-making than things people who fear that they are hierarchical.
Yeah.
So that doesn't surprise me. And I think that, look, I think this whole issue of women in tech is a great conversation. I think it was pushed forward by, I was very happy that it pushed forward last week with a guy like Satya Nadella, who by all accounts everyone loves and is a great person, but who got caught in a firestorm, and I think it's a healthy conversation to have. Mm-hmm. But I don't really see this issue as just a gender-specific one.
Sure.
It's about, and I think, and I talk a lot about psychic equity, I think that employers that allow people to have ideas, to be the skunks who are going to stink up the joint and get feel part of the whole, I think they're the ones that are going to attract the talent in the end. So that's what I believe. But we can talk later, offline.
That would be fantastic. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, Linda. It's a wonderful talk. Wonderful to hear you. I have a great follow-up. Thank you for setting the stage there, because I have a follow-up question to that. So as someone who's seen a lot of scale-ups and been a part of that,
yes.
My question is about that growth moment. How do you cultivate, how do you stay true to your culture and really try and cultivate the skunks from within as you're not necessarily at the point, 3,000 employees, you don't know all of them. How do you cultivate that top-down?
Well, I think that, there are, one of the stories also that I love is about WD-40, which I didn't know the story. The founder of WD-40, his name was Norm Larson, and he was trying to solve for rust in the 1950s. And he 39 formulas for water displacement fail, the 40th works, he brings it to General Dynamic, it works for the missiles, and employees start sneaking the formula home to fix their squeaky car doors. He's like, wait a minute, I have something here. He looks to name the company, looks in his lab book, water displacement, 40th formula, WD-40. So the name is embedded with the sense of failed attempts. And so the CEO today says, we're going to have learning moments. We are going to talk for every project. We're going to talk about what went wrong in addition to what went right. And that instills the sense that it is okay, it is acceptable to talk about what went wrong. Having said that, I will say one of the mistakes we find at that scale-up moment is being too open to change. So, in fact, studies have been done. Studies were done by a group of VCs and researchers here called Black Box about what's the right amount to pivot. And they actually found that companies that don't pivot at all, that are really just stubborn, often kill themselves. But companies that pivot once or twice are pretty much in the sweet spot, maybe third, And that companies that over-pivot, that over-get excited about the new thing, end up creating innovation suicide. And that more companies at the scale-up phase kill themselves by getting too unfocused than are killed by competitors in the marketplace. So just something to think about.
Strong leadership.
Be open to change, but not too open at that moment.
So I think we are out of time.
One more?
One more question. Sorry. We only have a limited amount of time.
Thanks.
You want to both ask the questions quickly,
both,
and then I'll do one.
Yes.
Yeah, let's both ask the questions.
Sure. So thanks a lot. My name is Victor. I'm founder of a company right now, and I wanted to ask two questions. You can choose which one if you want to answer one. One is, with all the entrepreneurs that you work with around the world, a lot of places that need entrepreneurship have problems with corruption, and that's often a big problem if you want to do something, but you don't want to do something that's corrupt, and sometimes you have to do that in places like India, which is where I was originally born.
Yep.
How do you advise people in those situations?
Yep.
And the second question, and this is equally for Reed, I guess, and for you, is there's a lot of excitement and energy around entrepreneurship, but there's often a dark side as well, right? Ben Horowitz has this post called The Struggle that talks about how hard it is. And a lot of people go through dark times. It's very lonely to sometimes do it. And I'm wondering if you could provide advice for folks that hit those times on their lows, right?
Yep.
When the world's telling you no, your wife's going to leave you, your house is going to be gone. I mean, kind of a country song. What kind of coping mechanisms have you all advised people that you work with as entrepreneurs? That would be really helpful.
And very quickly, the next question so that Linda will answer all of them.
Yeah, thank you. To what extent do you feel that your foreign language abilities affected your ability to make a strong network and a large network?
Yeah. It's amazing that crazy people, you know, in every language, you just move your hands and it doesn't matter what language you're speaking. We're now in 20 countries. You know, I don't speak most of the languages. I find the entrepreneur. I said once we had a group of entrepreneurs and they were, you know, Arabic, Portuguese, Turkish, Indonesian. I mean, it was Swahili, Spanish. It was, and someone walked in and said, and they were all flying and business cards are flying. And someone said, what language are they speaking? I said, entrepreneurship. I think getting back to your corruption, so here's the interesting thing we found at Endeavor. We've changed the playing field. If you think you can only get ahead locally, then your only chance you believe is to pay people off. You're told or you'll be run into the ground. We've had entrepreneurs do that. When they know that they're part of an international organization, if actually they want to go public or get sold to a big company, they're going to be proud and say, we are the clean company. And we've actually had companies bought out by multinationals because they were the clean company. And they were told when they were starting they were going to get killed because of it, and it actually helped them. So that's what we tell them, how we get around it. I've come to believe, you know, I went to two of the board members of Endeavor Brazil are the founders of 3G Capital. They took over Anheuser-Busch and Burger King and Heinz. And I went to them like 4 years ago, and I said, oh, why is it still so hard? When's it going to get easier? And they said, you know, being a pioneer is hard. If it were easy, someone else would have done your idea before. And that the, you know, hard is normal. The people, things aren't going to go back to normal. Hard is normal. And then they proceeded to tell me how much worse it was for them when they had to go through coups and 300% devaluation, and then I felt much better. So maybe the country songs will help. You're like, oh, he has much worse problems. But I also think that one of the things you said, Reed, is that talk about the pioneers and that step by step that you don't scale the planes in a day, and that, you know, Henry Ford has said any job is manageable as long as you break it into small parts, and this is why I talk about minovation and these strategic small risks. Richard Branson, you think of as this maverick, talks about contained disasters, so that if there's one disaster, not everything around you is going to collapse. So I often tell entrepreneurs, slow down, you know, breathe, and how do you figure out how to go step by step? You don't have to get there all at once, and then if you mess up, it's not also as drastic, but it's going to be hard.
Yeah, it will be hard, and one of the things that Endeavor provides is a network of support. So now we are at a tradition for Inform, which is 60-second idea for changing the world.
The clock is like ticking now.
No. They record it so they can take the few seconds after.
Okay, I'm going to go with, I think that if more people inside companies today became these entrepreneurs who stunk up the joint, then our companies and our big government would be a lot better off. So I'll go with that one.
I think it's a good one.
Thank you all.
Please thank Linda.